Good evening. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to Mind Over Matter, a monthly Juno KTOO radio show that explores issues of the heart as well as of the mind and body. Have you ever wondered if the medicine that your doctor recommended would really help, or even if there was a chance that it could actually harm you, or that the side effects could be worse than the cure? And what about the placebo effect? What do studies tell us about the power of our mind to heal? Does Western medicine, also called allopathic medicine, rely too much on drugs instead of simple, obvious lifestyle habits like weight control, exercise, and good nutrition? Well, these are a bushelful of questions that I would like to pose to tonight's guest, Dr. Emily Kane, a naturopathic physician in Juneau. Welcome to Mind Over Matter, Emily.
Thank you, Elaine.
Great having you back.
Nice to be here.
So, let's start out with what you think is essentially the state of our healthcare system.
That's a big question.
Yeah.
You know, just to put this all in context.
Bluntly, our healthcare system is a disease management system. It's been co-opted by corporate interests, and you never see advertising for steamed broccoli. Why is that? We don't need to advertise for things that are good for us. We only need to advertise for things that we need to persuade people that they need. So it's a conundrum to sort out what is right. Drugs do not promote health. They can be lifesavers. Don't get me wrong. I'm not dissing the advances that have been made with antibiotics and with surgery and triaging in the emergency room. But if you look at the package insert of most drugs, it says for short-term use. They're not intended for long-term use. There's no studies for long-term use. And many drugs are put forward as being the acme of how to treat a disease entity. And even the way that we study drugs is complex. For example, we sometimes we'll skim the abstract of a study, but we don't really dig into the details of the study, and sometimes the actual details very thinly support the benefit of the drug over the placebo effect. You mentioned placebo effect. It's huge. 40% of medicine is placebo effect. That relates somewhat to the compliant bias in the type of people who participate in clinical drug trials tend to be healthier, better educated, more likely to be following advances in medicine, and more likely to follow through. And those are generally healthier people. So people that are participating in drug trials often look healthier because they are healthier. They started out healthier. It's not that the drugs are making them healthier. You have to look at who's funding drug studies. And You have to look at where they're being published also. There's more and more drug studies that are open access, and that means that researchers actually pay to have their work published, and that, of course, will undermine the conflict of interest in getting the word out about this, that, or the other drug. So it's complicated to sort out if drugs are helpful.
I had a very interesting experience several years ago at a professional conference, and I attended a session on given by a medical anthropologist who had done research for a particular drug that was specifically for Alzheimer's. Okay, and she did this psychosocial research. She went in and interviewed the people. She didn't do the biological research, the psychosocial research. How did the patient feel? How did the family feel? All these things about the drug. And it came out essentially negative in that the drug that was used postponed the symptoms. So the person seemed to plateau for a while, but they had to stop the drug because that was part of the protocol. They couldn't take it forever. So when they stopped the drug, they crashed precipitously and their symptoms became extreme and were very upsetting. She reported that. That was part of the research package that was to be presented to the FDA. And when it came around for the FDA to look, because of the, this is what she said, because of the rules of the FDA, they could eliminate certain studies because they only had to provide X number of studies, and they eliminated hers. And she then subsequently went on to take a look at how that impacts FDA approval if the drug companies can eliminate studies that show negative impact.
It's called cherry picking. We're trying to change that. There's a worldwide movement right now that will require all studies to be published and to get airplay, negative or positive, because right now studies can be cherry picked, and that definitely puts a monkey wrench into the bias. The other thing that you mentioned, Elaine, is that there is no drug for Alzheimer's, there really is no successful drug for any neurodegenerative disease, and that's because fundamentally neurodegenerative disease is comprised of, there's three basic categories. There's low-grade chronic infections. Oral hygiene is huge. The advent of antibiotics that have mashed up our natural flora that help us to stay healthy. The microbiome has been definitively changed. There's lowering of neurotrophic factors. So as we age, testosterone goes down, estrogen goes down, nerve growth factor goes down, and all of these factors are lipid-based, and fats have been vilified. The brain is 85% fat. Good fat is where it's at, is what you need to get rid of is the carbs, because carbs are going to cause these insulin spikes, and that causes havoc with the metabolism in all sorts of ways and perpetuates inflammation. So chronic low-grade inflammation and infection, lowering of neurotrophic factors, things that help your brain and your nerve system to stay healthy, and then heavy metal toxicity. So toxins in general, all of our large fish have mercury in them at this point. These are the things that are causing brain degradation, and cleaning that all up is what's going to turn around this onslaught of neurodegenerative disease. There's not a drug. There's no magic bullet for Alzheimer's.
How do we clean it up?
We are smart about what we eat, and we do the basics. Good health is something that you work for, and it's really worth it. You drink water, you exercise regularly, you eat shiny, healthy, organic vegetables. You definitely minimize your processed carbs. It's a choice that you make every day. You make good dietary choices. You get enough sleep. You drink water. You hang out with people that you like. It's pretty basic, but it's something that you choose every day.
So what about, you spoke about big fish. So our big fish is halibut. Is that big enough, or are you talking about other varieties of big fish with mercury?
But I would recommend you eat salmon over halibut.
Okay.
So one of the most important ways that you can protect your brain is to not take drugs that lower your production of the number one component of what the brain is made out of. So the brain and the central nervous system is mostly made out of cholesterol. So not only is your brain and your central nervous system, the myelin sheath around your nerves, made out of cholesterol, but every single cell in your body, the trillions of cells in your body, the eye cells, the liver cells, the nerve cells, the bone cells, they're all surrounded by a cholesterol blanket that protects the nucleus. That's why when people take drugs that inhibit the production of cholesterol in your liver, which is one of the most important jobs that the liver has, is to make cholesterol so that that cholesterol can turn into steroids and turn into cell wall repair agents and turn into your central nervous system substrate, what the brain is made out of. So if you take statins, you're going to decrease your ability to repair your cells. And that's why people who are on statins for longer than 5 years have a much higher incidence of cancer and neurodegenerative diseases.
Is this proven?
This is proven. Google it. Type in Alzheimer's and statins. If you look at the second year medical school biochemistry at the lipid profile, so lipid means fat. The number one fat in the body is cholesterol. Cholesterol is the precursor for pregnenolone, progesterone, testosterone, estrogen, cortisol, the direct biochemical precursor. So if you're damping down your cholesterol production, you're going to be damping down all of these neurotrophic factors that are going to help keep your brain working and alive. There's a, you can see in the popular literature, GQ or whatever, there's an epidemic of low T. Why is there low testosterone out there? Guys, if you've got low T and you're on a statin, that's why.
Oh, what about the impact of taking statins on reducing the risk of heart disease?
Ah, thank you, Elaine. This is one of my favorite topics to unravel. So heart disease is way more complicated than the number 200. Heart disease usually means your arteries are getting clogged, or your heart as a muscle is boggy. It's just not in good shape. So it's harder to get the blood pumped, the oxygen-carrying blood pumping around the body and also to the brain. So you've either got some degree of congestive heart failure or you've got atherosclerotic plaque. Now, plaque, like the plaque on your teeth, mm-hmm. is made out of bacteria and calcium, but the plaque in your blood vessels is also made out of cholesterol, but cholesterol goes to an area of damaged artery because it's like a liquid Band-Aid. Remember, cholesterol is a repair agent. Cholesterol is your number one liquid Band-Aid that's floating around your blood, your whole body at all times looking for places to repair. The reason that the cholesterol comes on to repair these damaged arteries is because you're not ingesting the nutrients, the pigments, the anthocyanidins in the berries, the lycopene in the tomatoes, all these colors in vegetables that are so healing, that is what specifically repairs the inner lining of your blood vessel, the intimal media. The inner lining of the blood vessel needs these nutrients to stay velvety and functioning perfectly. If it gets dinged up with sugar and too much calcium and too many foreign chemicals like in drugs, then it gets tacky. It gets like Velcro on the inside of your blood vessels, and the calcium and the bacteria and the cholesterol start to glom on and form plaque. And as it builds up, the blood vessel gets narrower and narrower, and that's like stepping on the hose. It's going to increase your blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes people go and their cholesterol happens to be over 200, but their blood pressure is low. Right there, you know they do not have atherosclerotic plaque. Because if you have plaque, that means that the gauge of your blood vessels has been narrowed, and that is going to raise your blood pressure.
So are you saying that high cholesterol is almost always correlated with high blood pressure?
I'm saying the opposite. So you must not assume that if you have high cholesterol, it means you have high blood pressure. Many people have high cholesterol. Like, for example, when women go through menopause, their estrogen levels go down. So the feedback to the brain is, brain, make more cholesterol, because cholesterol is the immediate precursor for all of the hormones, including estrogen. And your body wants you to keep making babies as long as possible. That's how we're wired for procreation. So the liver revs up and produces more cholesterol. So when a woman goes through menopause and her cholesterol does not drift up 35 to 50 points, there's something wrong with her liver. I want her cholesterol to go up. And it has nothing to do with her blood pressure. The cholesterol isn't forming plaque. It's just forming hormones and doing cell wall repair.
So what do you think about medication to lower blood pressure?
I think it's important to lower blood pressure. High blood pressure is definitely a risk factor for eddying of the blood, creating clots, which creates stroke. We definitely want to try to prevent strokes because that can be extremely debilitating for not only the patient but for their caregivers. But taking a statin is just too facile, and it's generally not specific enough. Occasionally, people do have proven atherosclerotic plaque. I'll send people to the hospital for a carotid Doppler. So I'll take a look at their carotid artery and see if it's glommed up with plaque. And if it is, yeah, get them on a statin short term. It'll reduce the cholesterol production short term so they can do the lifestyle things they need to do to clean up their arteries. They can do chelation. They can improve their diet. There's things that can be done. But just being on cholesterol-lowering medication the rest of your life isn't going to do anything to improve your health. In fact, it's going to start degrading your health because you won't be able to produce these neurotrophic hormones.
Well, how did this reliance on drugs, or particularly, we can use statins as an example, come about in our medical world? And it's certainly come around in my field, psychotherapy. If you take a look at the training for psychiatrists, It has changed over the decades to mainly being psychotherapeutically oriented. We're psychiatrists. We're trained how to do psychotherapy. And that would be maybe 80% of their training or 90%, and the rest would be medication. To now, frequently, in most medical schools, it's the reverse. It's mainly training in prescribing psychotropic medication and not doing any psychotherapy.
We can unpack that a little bit. As you well know, what is easier, to have an in-depth, emotionally difficult counseling session for 55 minutes or to take out your pen and write a script? Okay, so we have been cornered into doing medicine by convenience. Also, conventional medical schools are largely funded by pharmaceutical companies, and the standard of care in a conventionally trained physician is very pharmaceutically driven. Now, I am fortunate in having a standard of care that's actually based on health-promoting measures. So if my patient comes to me with a cholesterol over 200, I am not legally obliged to recommend a statin to them. That's not my standard of care.
But an allopathic or traditional physician is legally required?
You know, yeah.
Or they could risk being sued?
Yes. Their standard of care is this medicine is offered with these parameters, but that it's not a one-size-fits-all situation. You have to take each patient individually and parse out where you can intervene to promote their health. You don't just want to lower their cholesterol. That could be harmful for them, and in fact, it often is harmful for them. So statins are one of my least favorite category of drugs because they do harm, and they really rarely promote the patient's health overall. There's a couple of other drug categories that I could provide examples for if you want to.
We can do that.
Time to move on for.
Before we move on to other drugs, you said that our medical system has focused on, I want to paraphrase you, something about, you know, drugs writing a script can be convenient, cheap, and quick, compared to, you were using the example of a 55-minute therapy session.
Well, I don't know about cheap, but yeah.
Yeah, it may not be cheap, exactly. So, what do you think are the historical influences in American medicine, and is it different from developed countries that have universal health care?
Oh, yes, absolutely, Elaine. I mean, where does the buck stop? So if the buck stops at a single payer, do you think that health becomes more financially interesting? Of course. But when the buck stops at big pharma, big agriculture, they want to sell their product. They really don't care about your health. I know that sounds cynical, but you have to look at, you have to follow the money, and health only becomes interesting in a single payer situation. That's why it's essential that we come into the civilized world as a nation and embrace the idea of a single payer. And I'm really hoping that that's going to continue to unfold over the next 4 and 8 years.
And let's point out to our listeners that the United States is the only industrialized country in the world that does not have universal health care.
And just in terms of basic parameters like maternal child mortality and childbirth, I mean, the United States is something like, you know, 37th, you know, and then Romania is 36th. I mean, it's just...
Oh, our results are way below.
Yeah, way below.
And
subpar.
Way below, subpar, and our costs are double for what most countries pay for health care. So looking that way, I remember when the Clintons were trying to get national health care going and how sad it was that Obama couldn't get a single-payer system or Medicare for all. And now, of course, Obamacare, the so-called Obamacare, is being criticized, but of course... In my view, it is because he had to settle for an imperfect system.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the main problem with the Affordable Care Act is that it's not affordable, but that's because it still involves this sort of layer of insurers and a lot of influence by drug and device manufacturers that have a lot of pull on Capitol Hill. And
So do you think, say, for example, the countries with the highest standard of medical care, which are probably the Scandinavian countries in northern Western Europe, Australia, Canada, do you think that they prescribe less statins, less this, less that?
Absolutely. They're less drugs, less vaccinated, much less obesity. They don't subsidize high fructose corn syrup and GMO grains. I mean,
it's more than drugs.
Oh, yeah. It's unfortunately, we have a medical industry that is not very smart about food, and we've got a food industry that really doesn't care about your health. And so we have to be wily consumers. And luckily, instead of just kind of railing against the machine, the only solution is to stay healthy and learn what you can about how your body works and how your body feels best. What do you need for your body to feel good? How many hours of sleep? How much water? How many vegetables? You know, try to feel as best as you possibly can and pick your way through. So that's the solution to the advertising pressures.
Well, you know, it seems like healthcare is very parallel to the discussion we've been having around the elections and the influence of money on our politicians and on our domestic and foreign policy. So that big pharma would be lobbying constantly not to have a nationalized health system. The insurance companies would be doing the same thing. I wonder, because there's so much drug promotion, I remember I've been a psychotherapist for 35 or more years, maybe close to 40. And what I've seen over time is the increased prescription of, particularly we'll talk about antidepressants. So in the old days, you did not prescribe an antidepressant unless someone had very, very serious, clinical
major depressive episodes
condition.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. And
it's commonplace in 2 and 3 year olds, which is absolutely shocking. So the SSRIs are a very popular category of antidepressants, and I just want to very briefly explain how those work. It's the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And without going into too much detail, it basically makes your body think that you've got more of the feel-good serotonin going on, but in reality, the drug's feedback creates a dialing down of the production of serotonin. That's why it's so difficult to get off these drugs, because you take them for a while and then your body's like, oh, I've got lots of serotonin, and then the nerves that produce serotonin start producing less. So then when you stop your Prozac or your Effexor or your Lexapro, whatever it is, you're in a hole and you feel terrible, and the only thing that you want to think about is getting back on that drug. And that's worked just great for the pharmaceutical industry. If you look at the package insert, again, it says for short-term use. There really are no good long-term studies. You know why? Because the long-term studies, the ones that they are horrible. Every single one of the mass shootings that has popularized and have captured our, you know, popular psyche, every single one of those, the shooter was on an SSRI or recently had been experimenting with SSRI. So if you have doubt the verity of what I'm saying, go to amoland.com. This is very well documented. Many, many suicides are precipitated by people being desperate about their meds and changing up their meds, and they're changing their meds and they fall into a hole and they're in so much pain they see no other way out. So the serotonin blocking drugs are rarely the way to make you feel better. I am a big proponent of, this is where the mind body part comes in, Elaine, is it's very difficult for your mind to be happy unless your body, and even like specifically the center of your body, the inner tube of your body that interfaces with the outside world, and I'm talking about the gastrointestinal tract. So if your guts hurt, if you don't have a nice, happy, easy to pass poop every day, if your belly's always feeling bloated and you're always feeling yucky after eating, it's going to be hard for your brain to be happy. So one of the solutions to depression is to take care of your body. Let's fix your gut. The gut is like right at the center of your being. It's got to feel good. So taking an SSRI, interestingly, most of the serotonin in your body is not produced in your brain, but in your gut.
Hmm. Okay, let's take a short break with some good music, and then Dr. Emily Kane and I'll be right back to talk more about prescription drug use in America. in the studio tonight is Dr. Emily Kane, a naturopathic physician with a long-time medical practice here in Juneau. How long have you been in practice in Juneau?
Almost 25 years.
Wow. I think I met you the day you came here. It's been a while. I was here, too, 35 years ago. So what we're talking about is the use and misuse of drugs to treat medical conditions. Emily, I have a question. Is there an increase in autoimmune disease? And if so, what do you think that's about?
Absolutely. There's a huge uptick. One of the biggest upticks is in thyroid autoimmune. The type of thyroid, low thyroid function that's autoimmune is called Hashimoto's thyroiditis. There's also an uptick in rheumatoid arthritis, which is the immune system attacking the synovial fluid that bathes the small joints. There's an uptick in MS, multiple sclerosis, which is the immune system attacking the myelin sheath that protects the nerves. There's an uptick in celiac disease, which may or may not be a confusion about what is good for the body and what isn't good for the body. So in autoimmune disease, what's happening is that the immune system is getting confused about what is foreign and what is self. So your immune system is designed to tag anything that comes into the body, and about 75% of all preventable pathologies come into the body through the mouth, and the other 25% come in through the respiratory system. And these are largely preventable problems due to pollution or poor food and water quality, so on, that we can try to make our way around. But if we are constantly stimulating our immune system unnecessarily, it's going to start to get confused and start to attack our own self tissues. Just as an aside before I go on about why we have more autoimmune disease, is that one of my approaches to any type of autoimmune disease is to help the person be very clear about who they are and what is real for them. And this may sound kind of harsh, but if someone, for example, is in a job that they hate, or they're in a relationship that really gives them grief every day, they're not being true to themselves, and it's going to make it much more difficult for them to heal from an autoimmune situation. So it's very important to be true to yourself and to be authentic. We really, our own self-care is the only thing we have some control over in the world. And I encourage everybody to exert that. So one of the main reasons why our immune system is getting confused is because the digestive system is supposed to break everything we put into our mouth down into highly absorbable little bits. Like for protein, it's the amino acids. For fats, it's the essential fatty acids. And for carbohydrates, it goes all the way down to glucose. So those very small molecules is what are meant to be going through the intestinal wall and into the bloodstream that then gets developed into repair, tissue, repair your eyeballs, repair your liver, make more blood, so on, keep the machine of the body all going. But what happens is that when we eat food that's subpar, it irritates our gut.
What's subpar?
Subpar is GMO. Subpar is something that was actually alive in the ground 10 years ago. You know, if you put a Twinkie out on your back deck, the bugs aren't even going to eat it. So a nutrition professor of mine once said, don't eat anything that wouldn't rot, but eat it before it does. And actually, I'm a big fan of, like, right on the edge there when it's starting to ferment. Fermented food is a great way to get your probiotics and to start healing your gut. So eating food that was highly processed, that grew decades ago, that was shipped in from 1,000 miles away, you know, this is all suboptimal ways of eating. And it's so encouraging to see the community farms and people in downtown Juneau having chickens. And, you know, there's a critical mass of people really moving in the right direction to reclaim their health. But if your gut lining is disturbed because of eating what Michael Pollan might call food-like substances that really aren't food, really don't qualify as food, but we eat them all the time. It takes up the two-thirds of the center of the grocery store. So you're eating that stuff all the time, and your gut gets irritated, and it starts to leak. So leaky gut may sound like a weird thing, but what it really means is that the integrity of the tube has been compromised, and undigested food starts circulating in the blood, and that is going to engender an immune response. So you're unnecessarily kicking on your immune system. And your immune system basically means your white blood cells. White blood cells are made in the bone marrow, the B cells. They're called B cells because they're made in the bone marrow. That's the workhorses of your immune system. And there's only a finite amount of them that gets produced every day. So if you're using up half of your B cells dealing with food-like substances, you don't have a lot of immune power left over for all the circulating pathogens, the bugs, and everything else that might be going around. So you've got to preserve your immune function, not confuse it. One of the contributors to leaky gut, besides food-like, non-food-like food, is the legion prescriptions for proton pump inhibitors or acid blockers. So people suffer from heartburn. Okay, the lesion in heartburn is not your stomach acid. You need stomach acid. Your stomach is designed to make stomach acid. Your parietal cells secrete stomach acid to sterilize the food, to break down the protein, and to stimulate the downstream digestive function of the bile from the liver and the pancreatic enzymes from the pancreas. You've got to have an acidic bolus of food coming into the upper small intestine for the rest of the digestive function to happen. So we're chronically seeing people taking stomach acid blockers. They're blocking their stomach acid, and then they're trashing their digestive system. Their digestion is not going to work well if you're taking an acid blocker. So if you're having heartburn, it's not because you've got stomach acid. It's because you ate way too much of a dinner and then slumped on the sofa and you pushed your stomach up against your diaphragm and you opened that little valve that separates the esophagus from the stomach. So the lesion in gastroesophageal reflux disease, GERD, or heartburn, is a hiatal hernia. It's the reflux of the food up, not because you have acid in your stomach. You're supposed to have acid in your stomach. It's because you've eaten too much, and then you're slumping on the sofa and pushing your food up. So, yeah, come and see me if you want to have a look and figure out how to really treat your heartburn. And it's very satisfying to be able to manage your life without drugs. And you can start on a path of health. But if you're having terrible heartburn and there's nothing else you can do for here and there, okay, maybe you can take a Tums here and there. But as a long-term scheme, it's terrible because it's going to wreck your digestive function, which is going to wreck your immune system.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there any other particular medications or drugs? Antibiotics, for example.
Yeah.
Do you have any comments on, oh my gosh, that's a huge topic because obviously what's going on in the world is that bugs are becoming immune. They're becoming antibiotic resistant. And we can see this. I've lived in Asia for years, and it's pretty scary.
Yeah, it is scary, and it's one of the reasons that you want to preserve your immune system. Actually, my daughter in college right now is working on a fascinating breath test to do early detection of infectious diseases, which if we catch diseases way earlier without the trauma of having to go to the doctor and get your blood drawn and have it sent off to the lab to analyze, which is lengthy and expensive, but capturing breath, and I actually learned that marine biologists are doing this with whales, too. They're trying to capture the blowout emissions to determine what the health of the whale is, because just when you start to get a little off, your breath changes, and that can be methane, and various halogen levels can be detected and then can be attributed to where you are on the spectrum of health. So if we do early detection of infection, then we'll be able to apply lower-level therapies and kind of nip it in the bud. So that's one way around this antibiotic problem. I think in general, the medical community, and we have a fabulous medical community here in Juneau. One of my favorite parts of the Juneau medical community is that almost all of the doctors here are open-minded and really care about delivering good patient care, but as my favorite part is they're by and large very healthy people, and they set a good example for their patients, and that's, I think, really important for a doctor to be healthy.
My doctor is supremely healthy, and I always run into her hiking, and she's jogging, and you know, she's a perfect role model for leading a healthy life. And you're right, when I think of my doctor friends, they're shining examples of exercise and good eating and good weight and, you know, the good life.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful, actually, to be a doctor in Juneau, because you're not part of some big HMO on hourly or, you know, having to push people through. We have smaller practices here. And I just want to...
I just want to say a little bit, just to finish up about the antibiotics.
Oh,
so
yeah.
The medical community as a whole is doing a really good job with limiting their antibiotic prescription. Of course, that's going to help to stem this issue of creating more and more resistant superbugs. One area that antibiotics will still get prescribed with some frequency is chronic sinusitis, and this is a big issue in Juneau. You know, we've got sort of a damp, slightly moldy atmosphere here, and there's a lot of sinusitis walks through my door, and often the patients have been on round and round and round of antibiotics. You know, that's like started with a Z-Pak and then it's kind of moved up to the Cipro and kind of more broad spectrum, slightly nastier side effect delivering drugs, and it's not really doing the trick. And I just would like to mention that most chronic sinusitis is not a bacterial infection at all. It's a fungal infection, and you do not give antibiotics for fungal or viral infections. So just be clear that you've got a bacterial infection, and ideally do a culture and sensitivity and get the specific antibiotic. And I think that's about all I have to say about antibiotics right now. Just stay healthy if you can. There is another category of medicine that is widely prescribed, and I think that's overprescribed, and it's very topical right now, Elaine, and that's the issue of opiates.
Yeah.
And opiates came into bigger vogue 20, 30 years ago, where there was a large advertising push by pharmaceutical interests to tell doctors that their patients deserve to not suffer from pain. So, you know, back in the 50s and the 60s, the only time you would ever give a narcotic, which is highly addictive and really doesn't solve the problem at all, it just shuts off the pain signal to your brain, and it's highly addictive, that was only given for terminal cancer pain. That was the only situation in which narcotics were given. And that changed with this big advertising push to make doctors feel guilty about letting their patients suffer. But, you know, there's many other ways to deal with pain. The National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health this week published a meta-analysis of studies that show that acupuncture is very useful for back pain and for osteoarthritis of the knee. Massage therapy is very useful for neck pain and back pain. Osteopathic manipulation, very effective for back pain. Various relaxation techniques, such as meditation or yoga, very effective for severe headaches and migraine, which are almost impossible to treat reliably long-term with drugs. Also for fibromyalgia, relaxation techniques work very well. Chiropractic-type spinal manipulation, study after study says that it helps back pain. Tai Chi, great for osteoarthritis of the knee and of the shoulder, good for fibromyalgia. Yoga is good for back pain. I am so glad that we are decriminalizing cannabis. I think that there is over half of the states have now decriminalized it for medical use. The Journal of the American Medical Association has an editorial that's this week. The title is four words: opiates out, cannabis in.
Wow.
The Journal of the American Medical Association. Yay. I mean, one of the the best parts about the legalization of cannabis. And tonight we're going to hear about how that goes in California, right? Okay, and that if you know the way California goes, so goes
the nation.
Yes. So we hope that that can be one of Obama's executive orders. The JAMA is also calling to move cannabis from a Schedule 1, which is incredibly ridiculous, to a Schedule 2, which even still is still ridiculous, because a Schedule 1 drug means A, it's highly addictive, which cannabis isn't, and B, it has no therapeutic potential. And cannabis has so much therapeutic potential. It's great for pain. It's great for anxiety. It's fantastic for neurodegenerative disease. It nourishes our endocannabinoid system. I wanted to mention that one of the biggest contributors to the anti-pot movement is the makers of fentanyl, the anesthetic that's widely used in surgical procedures. So the makers of fentanyl have put millions of dollars into suppressing the voter initiatives to decriminalize pot.
And now that's also being added to heroin, right?
Yeah. Well, it's become a street drug as well.
It's become. Yeah. Oh, so the makers of fentanyl are opposing the legalization of medical marijuana or marijuana.
The medical symbol that is used in the conventional medical arena is a staff with two snakes winding around the staff. It's called the caduceus. That's the sort of the symbol of the medical profession. Supposedly I've heard on several different places that staff is the cannabis staff. Cannabis is one of the oldest medicines in both Western and Ayurvedic and traditional Chinese medical pharmacopoeias. The plant evolved with humans on the planet. It grows like a weed everywhere, and it's good medicine. Now, the thing is the dose, because it has been bred to have high THC, so you do want to know what you're getting. In Alaska, the legal dose of THC per serving is 5 milligrams. You're just going to get like a little sparkle with that. For therapeutic use, you know, for epilepsy, they're using 250 milligrams a day kind of thing, just to give you a sense. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be a very helpful part of overcoming opiate overdoses, and in states like Colorado that have legalized, have been on the forefront of legal medical marijuana, the opiate overdose deaths have dramatically decreased. And guess what? So have fatal car accidents. So there's been some kind of buzz out there about how, okay, now we're going to have like, you know, stoned car accidents. You know what? It's not happening, folks. I mean, you know, show me some research that says that.
I read some interesting research, and it was in the Juno Empire, and it had one big mistake. It started talking about marijuana and how the marijuana, you know, in states where marijuana is legalized, and then it went on to talk about how many traffic accidents there were with people who were under the influence of drugs, and they didn't say what drug. So the article was implying it was marijuana, but when you looked at it carefully, it didn't say that they selected out marijuana at all. So something's going on there, I think.
Well, we're breaking down that prohibition. I mean, when you think about how much more lethal and cardiotoxic and neurotoxic and hepatotoxic alcohol is, alcohol is the gateway drug.
I want to, since we're talking about opiates, is there some connection with Big Pharma? On a previous radio show, a woman who is working to stop heroin deaths in Juneau said that Purdue Pharmaceutical has some possible role in this huge opiate problem we're having now.
Oh, absolutely. Well, they way overproduced OxyContin. They flooded the market with OxyContin. They made it cheap and very available. And
is that legal?
No, technically not. But the checks and balances, technically, pharmacies, registered pharmacies, are supposed to put in an order to the manufacturer of the opiate as to about how much the patient demand, you know, how much they'll need, and the opiate manufacturer is supposed to produce enough to meet the legitimate pharmacy's demand. But in the case of Purdue, they way overproduced, and they got fined for that, but they just wrote the check. So
And so, okay, so it's one of those laws where it's cheaper to break it. It's cheaper to pay the fine and pollute, sort of like cruise ship pollution.
Yeah.
Okay. And we know who lobbies for those lenient laws. The people follow the money, as you say. If you've just joined us, I'm Elaine Schroeder, and with me is Dr. Emily Kane, who's sharing with us her view of the widespread use of certain prescribed drugs in America, in the American medical model, and we've compared it to Europe and elsewhere, places with universal health care. So now let's take a short break for a little bit of music, and then we have a little time left to finish up our show. Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio tonight is Dr. Emily Kane, a Juno naturopathic physician who has been in medical practice, has a medical practice here in Juno for over 25 years.
Almost
25 years. And what we're taking a look at, a critical look at, some common medical practices, prescription drugs, and other practices. And Emily, I remember reading what I thought was a really, really interesting article in one of my favorite journals, and it talked about that medicine, a medical system for profit is not a medical system for health. It was really saying, and this must have been during the Obamacare legislation being fought, how it's just simply incompatible. When I talk about, I'm not talking about a physician making money or a nurse making money or a naturopath making money. What we're talking about is the whole system completely based, including drug companies and insurance companies, as well as the practitioners themselves, completely based as a profit model. And it's simply not working. And I've often questioned how often I should get mammograms. To be honest, I'm a little bit suspicious in America that I'm being overprescribed everything, and that my mom died fairly young of breast cancer, so I'm a little wary of over-radiation. How do you feel how do you feel about mammograms?
Mammograms are a poor screening tool. I think they work quite well as a diagnostic tool. I remember seeing a advertisement for, it was a YouTube that was made for the mammography van that drives around in the bush and tries to rope women in the villages to come and get their annual mammogram. And it's well-intentioned. I do believe that it's well-intentioned. But I remember watching the clip of the women sitting around having coffee after having gotten their mammograms, and they were sort of chatting together, and they were more or less saying to each other, well, I had my annual mammogram, so I'm not going to get breast cancer this year. And that really struck me, because of course that isn't said per se. Most of the mammography equipment is produced by General Electric, in case anybody wants to do socially responsible stock investing. So what's put out there is this notion that if you fall into place and get your annual mammogram, you're going to lower your risk of getting breast cancer. And, you know, the opposite is possibly true. So it's complicated because the women who are, like we talked about, the compliance bias, if you're someone who follows orders and you try to go to the doctor regularly, you're probably trying to take care of your health. But mammography is not benign, so screening tools should not cause harm, and radiation causes cancer. So ionizing radiation year after year to the breast tissue is not a good idea. I'm just going to come right out and say it. So I recommend generally a baseline mammogram by the time a woman is 40, because then later, as she's doing her regular breast self-exam in the shower, every time she takes a shower, you're soaping up your armpits, feel for lumps and bumps in your armpits, and then you check both breasts at the same time. You're looking for asymmetrical lumpy bumpy. A lot of women don't do breast self-exam because breast tissue is naturally lumpy and bumpy. Fibrocystic breast tissue is normal. But cancer is going to render that lumpy bumpiness asymmetrical. So if you ever feel kind of a lumpy bumpy on one side that you don't feel on the other side, then you go to your doctor and say, what do you think about this? And she'll say, well, it's right there. Let's just go right to a biopsy. Or she'll say, yeah, I'm not sure. It feels like it could be a cyst. We can get an ultrasound. That'll tell me it's fluid filled and we know right away it's not a tumor. Or you can get a mammogram at that point as a diagnostic tool. But you don't want to use mammograms as a screening tool because they confer risk. Radiation is one of the things that causes cancer. So let's not overdo on the radiation. It's important to understand our medical tools, what they do for us. And just for example, a PAP is a screen for the human papillomavirus on the cervix. So nuns never get cervical cancer. It's an STD. Human papillomavirus is an STD. So if you're in a mutually monogamous relationship and you've had three good PAPs in a year, you don't have to keep scraping your cervix year after year. So it's important to understand what the medical tools are for. I think sometimes we get told to come and get our annual because the physician wants to make sure that your blood pressure is good and that you're not in a domestic violence situation. And, you know, it's just a way of kind of getting women in to get their checkup, which isn't necessarily a bad idea, but you don't have to get a mammogram or even a PAP every year. So I'm a big fan of breast self-exam. That has been dissed in the conventional medical arena because patients are made to feel that they can't be as expert about bodies as their doctors. But let me tell you, you are the expert on your body. So just go for it. Learn more about it.
And let's wind up with sort of your summation of how to be as healthy as we can be.
Oh, thank you for that opportunity, Elaine. I would like to say that feeling good takes work, but it is so worth it. So every day when you get up, set your mind to choosing healthy, vibrant foods, to drinking mostly water, to getting some kind of exercise, move every day, and feel happy. Be willing to smile at people on the street. Go ahead and just have a little fun and get enough sleep. And in terms of sleep, you have to work backwards from when you need to get up the next morning and make sure that you put yourself to bed 8 hours before you have to wake up the next morning. So that kind of self-care is what's going to, on a day-to-day basis, promote your health. And drugs can get you through a critical crisis, but they're never the long-term solution. You taking care of your health on a day-to-day basis is what's going to make you feel good, keep you vibrant, and help you age gracefully.
Oh, thank you, Emily. I want to thank you for sharing your views and knowledge about what truly improves our health and well-being. And I'd also like to thank Jeff Brown, who's supported me for years and years doing this program. And today he is the technical support for this show. And good night to all of our Southeast Alaska listeners. Please tune in on another Monday next month at 7 p.m. to K2 for another edition of Mind Over Matter. Good night.